It's Tuesday, April 5th. It's about 3 o'clock, and present are Representative Talrico, Foster, Wool, myself, Chair Seaton. Representative Tarr will return in a moment. And I'd like to remind everybody about their cell phones. And then also, we have three bills up today, so we've got a fairly tight schedule. House Bill 345, Insurance Coverage for Contraceptives, is our first hearing. We have then House Bill 334, Child Custody, Domestic Violence, Child Abuse, and 315, Electronic Visit Verification and Medicaid. So we'll be taking testimony on 345, but only as much as time allows, as we have to address the other bills. And so we may get short on public testimony there. So we'd appreciate people doing it quickly. And we have a CS for 345. We also have a CS for 334 being drafted as we speak. So we will address that when we get to it on the list. And then we have amendments for House Bill 315. So, Representative Talrico.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that the committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 345, version 29-LS1503/H as a working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for discussion, and will the sponsor come forward and present the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and would you just quickly address the changes from the earlier bill to this one. You can either do that as you go through, or you can just list the change and then just proceed with the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm Representative Matt Klayman, State Representative from House District 21. I actually am going to defer on the changes to the CS to my staff because she can address that more effectively than I can.
That would be fine. Would you introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and let us know about the changes between the versions?
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Megan Kavanaugh, and I'm staff to Representative Klayman. Thank you all for hearing House Bill 35 today. The changes from version A of the bill to the CS, which is version H, originally version A included provisions which applied to over-the-counter contraceptives. Those provisions, which you can find in version A, section 1, page 1 of the bill, lines 11 and 12, section 1, page 2 of the bill, lines 16 and 17, and section 2, page 3 of the bill, lines 18 and 19, were all removed in version H, and that's the extent of the changes from version A to version H of the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, Representative Klayman, would you like to introduce the bill and let us know what we're dealing with? And Representative Tarr has rejoined us.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And again, Matt Klayman from House District 21. And thank you for hearing House Bill 345. This bill provides women the option to receive 12 months of a prescription contraceptive at one time. And the most important supporters in this are the women from my family who all support the bill, which tells me a lot. They support it not only because it is often time-consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraceptive every 3 months, or in some cases every month, but they also support it because they know that improved access to contraceptives means huge reductions in unintended pregnancies. Those pregnancies have adverse maternal and child health outcomes and other social and economic challenges. I believe, and I hope the members of this committee will agree, that with Alaska's fiscal challenges, we should look for ways to reduce the cost in both short-term and long-term, and this bill does that. And so I'm going to actually then turn it over to Megan Kavanaugh, my chief of staff, to explain further the details of the bill.
Okay, once again, Megan Kavanaugh, staff to Representative Klayman for the record. And first and foremost, I just want to address that the fiscal note that was sent out earlier today, I believe, reflects version A of the bill rather than version H of the bill. The department has worked on the fiscal note for the Senate companion of House Bill 345, which I believe was sent out to the committee members. I'm not positive about that. But the companion SB 156 has received a fiscal note that reflects a $1.3 million cost savings to the state. And I think there's a representative from the Department of Health and Social Services here who could talk a little bit more about how those savings were calculated.
And before you proceed, I want members to know that that Senate fiscal note, which is the same companion of this, is on your desk. So, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Megan Kavanaugh, staff to Rep. Klayman. House Bill 345 mandates that health care insurers provide coverage for a prescriptive contraceptive up to 12 months at one time. In the bill, prescriptive contraceptives include self-administered hormonal contraceptives that do not require insertion or other types of administration by a medical professional, namely oral contraceptives, commonly known as the pill. Section 1 of the bill lays this out and includes a religious exemption, as well as it defines a health care insurer as including a self-insured employer, such as the state. Section 2 of the bill directs the Department of the Health and Social Services to cover the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives for eligible recipients of medical assistance. Section 3 of the bill allows for the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives to be made available to Medicaid recipients. Section 4 of the bill is a conditional effect of Section 2, and Sections 5 and 6 pertain to effective dates. Now I just want to talk a little bit more about one of the major premises behind House Bill 345 is that when women have greater access and availability to contraceptives, unintended pregnancies are reduced. Reductions in unintended pregnancies have a direct cost savings to the state, and that's reflected in the fiscal note that is the Senate companion version of the bill. According to a study, which I believe is in your packets, in 2010, 48% of all pregnancies, which were roughly 8,000 in Alaska, so 48% of those 8,000 pregnancies were unintended. The study uses the Center for Disease Control's definition of an unintended pregnancy to mean one that was either mistimed or the woman did not want to become pregnant at that time. Additionally, that study estimates that 3,000 or 64.3% of the unplanned pregnancies in 2010 were publicly funded. As a state, Alaska spent just about $113 million on unintended pregnancies, and of that, 70.8% was funded by the federal government and 42.9% by the state. We know that these costs also have impacts down the line on programs like the foster care system and the child's overall well-being. An additional study, I think, which is also included in your packet, looks at 84,000 women in California who are given various supplies, 1 month, 3 month, and year-long of oral contraceptives. The researchers of that study observed a 30% reduction in the odds of pregnancy when given the year-long supply of oral contraceptives. The study also showed that California's family planning program paid $99 more annually for women who received three cycles and $44 more for women who received one cycle than it did for the women who received the 12-month supply all at once. This was mostly due to pregnancy tests and the associated visits. For those women who received three cycles were almost twice as likely than women who received 12 months to visit a clinic to get a pregnancy test. I also believe the lead author of that study is online and can address further questions about that study after I've finished here. One thing I want to note that's important about this bill is that it does not change who is eligible for coverage or what kind of prescriptions are being covered. All the bill does is allow women who already receive coverage for prescription contraceptives to receive, if she so chooses, 12 months of that prescription at one time. I did want to note, for full disclosure, that we have received some concerns from the Small Business Association about whether the bill would apply to self-insured entities such as the state. We have and will continue to work with that group to address their concerns. An important inclusion in the bill is the definition of a healthcare insurer to include a self-insured entity, and that has helped to address some of their concerns. And like I said, we're definitely willing to work with them some more. Overall, House Bill 345 would have huge advantages for Alaskan women from eliminating the inconvenience of refilling the prescription every 1 or 3 months at a time to the real inability for some Alaskan women to make it to the clinic, hospital, or pharmacy to refill that prescription at all. Fisherwomen sometimes spend 3 to 4 months out on the boat at one time. Women who are attending UAA often have busy schedules balancing school and a job. Women in rural Alaska often have trouble making it to the clinic or hospital due to lack of transportation and limited operating hours. This bill ensures all Alaskan women's freedom to make decisions about their future. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Well, thank you. Are there questions? I don't see. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think it might be worth putting on the record one more time. The fiscal note that we should be looking at The Senate bill shows a $1.3 million savings every year.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tarr, that is correct. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? Okay, thank you. We'll go to public testimony. And let's see, did we have? And the first one is invited testimony. Diane Foster, are you online?
Yes, I am here. Thank you so much, Chairman and Representative Quammen, for inviting me to come give testimony. I am a California researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, and I was asked by the state of California to evaluate the impact of, actually they were hoping to cut costs by removing what had been a long-standing ability of clinics to dispense a one-year supply. But before they decided to cut that benefit, they allowed me to analyze it. And what I found was that, in fact, that benefit was associated with cost savings. So we found that the state saved actually almost $100 over the course of the year for women who received a one-year supply because they were having fewer clinic visits and fewer pregnancy tests. And the pregnancy test was particularly concerning for women who are receiving multiple pregnancy tests. We were worried they were also having unwanted pregnancies. And so the second study that we did actually linked their family planning dispensing to claims for pregnancies, so births and abortions, and we found, in fact, that women who receive a one-year supply were less likely to have either a birth or an abortion in the subsequent year. And oral contraceptives are the most commonly used reversible methods of contraception in the United States, and most unintended pregnancies and most abortions occur to women who are actually using contraceptives, but they're using them inconsistently. And so one in five women in abortion clinics report that they had unprotected sex because they ran out of birth control, and a similar percentage of women who never had an abortion but had had unprotected sex report that they had run out of birth control. And so I think there's great potential for making this change to enable women to avert pregnancies that they don't desire.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And would you restate your name for the record?
Diana Green Foster.
Thank you. And I do have questions for Dr. Foster. I don't see any. I would note that we have a synopsis anyway of your research in our packet, and it was very, very enlightening. And thank you very much for that. So seeing no questions, we will go to Kenai, to Kenny Pest. Oh, no, it's in Palmer. Kenny Peskin-Linden. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing the name. If you can hear me, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kenny Pesenik-Linden, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself today. I live in Palmer, where I was born and raised with my husband. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 345. As a college student, I was diagnosed with stage 4 endometriosis. I was prescribed hormonal birth control to preserve my future ability to have children. It became imperative that I was able to receive and take my hormonal birth control continuously without any gaps in order to control my severe endometriosis. More than once, I had to switch from my preferred method of birth control because of travel plans. I was unable to receive more than 1 month at a time, which was a barrier when I spent summers abroad. Having all 12 months at once would have been a huge relief and would have given me much needed peace of mind about my health and my ability to choose what was best for me in consultation with my doctor. I would also like to ask that the bill ensures that it addresses dependents' access to birth control. While a college student, when I was diagnosed, I was covered by my parents' insurance, and it was a struggle to make sure that my hormonal birth control was covered, even though it was for medical reasons. Access to hormonal birth control saved my health and my fertility. Although I experienced the health difficulties associated with endometriosis, including multiple surgeries, near constant pain and debilitating nausea, and barriers to contraceptive access, I was able to graduate from college because I was prescribed hormonal birth control. Again, thank you for your time, and I would like to encourage the committee in the strongest terms to support House Bill 345. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Seeing none, let's go to Robin Smith in Anchorage. Are you there, Robin?
Yes, I am here. Thank you so much.
Would you identify yourself?
My name is Robin Smith, and I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. I want to say that I think this bill is a very good bill, and there really should be no reason not to pass this on because it is cost savings. Maybe some people will have may not like it because they think it's a way of letting people be more sexually active, but to me, it's a preventative care bill. And what we're preventing here is we're preventing unintended births or unwanted births, and we're preventing abortions. But that's not the only reason that women take birth control. And so I just want to give you a little more information that it's preventative care for a lot of preventative care as well as treatment for a lot of other issues. So there's protection. There are 10 reasons why a doctor might prescribe birth control pills other than to prevent pregnancy. One is protection against ovarian and endometrial cancer. Women that have taken the pill for 5 years or longer have a 50% reduction in the risk of developing ovarian cancer, and that benefit continues even after stopping the pill. This is according to Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We're talking about a cancer which there is not a good screening tool for, and a cancer that's frequently diagnosed in the advanced stages. So to have this kind of risk reduction is very important. Also, a recent analysis of 36 studies found that for every 5 years that a woman takes birth control, her reduction of endometrial cancer decreases by nearly a quarter. That benefit continues even more than 30 years after the woman stopped taking the pill. You can also prevent ovarian cysts, and by preventing ovarian cysts, you prevent possible surgeries. You, as the last person testified, you can prevent and treat endometriosis. You can also prevent anemia. 10% of women have very heavy menses or menorrhea, and this can lead to anemia. You can treat, you can avoid migraines that are associated with menstrual periods. Also, you can treat PMS, treat acne, treat excess hair growth that also comes along, and you can balance a hormone deficiency. There are women who do not menstruate. This condition is called amenorrhea, and this can be caused by weight loss, not enough body fat, or exercise. These women are estrogen depleted, and that may lead to osteoporosis, yet another concern that we have with women. So the bottom line is, it's really beneficial if women can have access and don't have to go back to the pharmacy every 30 days, particularly in Alaska. I mean, I find it difficult myself not to make it all the way to the pharmacy whenever my 30 days are up with different pills that I'm on a long-term regular basis. So this is a positive for Alaska. I see no negatives about it, even for small businesses. My husband's a small business owner, and it's been required by the ACA that we provide birth control. So thank you, and I hope you pass HB 345.
And thank you for your testimony. And now we will go to Katarina Reynolds in Homer. Katarina, are you on there? And can you, I do want to let everybody know that we have to leave this bill about 3:35. So if people can give us their testimony quickly, that is a help.
Katriona, I think it's Katriona.
Yeah, Katriona.
Yep, this is Katriona Reynolds here in Homer, and the clinic manager at the Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic, where I've been for 13 years, and I am speaking on behalf of the organization as well as myself. And thank you for your time today, Representative Seaton, and the rest of the committee. I have sent you a pretty lengthy document in your email, 2 pages. There's a lot of data and facts in there. I don't want to reiterate too much of that in respect to that 2 minutes. but a woman's consistent access to birth control shouldn't depend on her insurance carrier. And by requiring that women get 12 months of birth control at a time, we can reduce barriers to contraceptives and prevent unintended pregnancy and save money, too. But it does need to be recognized that a supply for 12 months might require up to 17 packs or cycles of a contraceptive method, depending on the instructions for use that the prescriber has written. I can tell you more about that if you would like me to. So while there's a lot of data out there, I do know that people have wanted to know how that plays out in real life. And because of the unique way that we're able to work at KBFPC, I've seen the benefit of providing 12 months supplies in action. Quite a large number of our clients are uninsured, and so we provide birth control to them from our own supplies, and we're able to compare their compliance with taking one pill every day and continuing for a year compared to people who have to pick up one pack at a time from the pharmacy or 3 months at a time. And definitely the anecdotal reports from clients are that it's much easier to be consistent with a birth control when they have access to 12 months at a time. See, what else should I highlight right now? I think what I'm going to do is just get off and make sure that everybody has time to speak today. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Katriana. Other questions? Seeing none, let's now go to Petersburg to Stephen Samuelson. And then we'll go to Elizabeth Figus next. Welcome. Would you put yourself on the record with your name and who you represent, and go ahead with a short testimony?
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Samuelson, five generations, Southeast, Petersburg, Juneau, wherever the job is. You know how that works. I didn't know I was going to testify on this today, but I am in support of this House Bill 345. And the reason being is that I don't think that anybody should be hindered by legislation that will affect their health or whatever they've determined between a doctor or whatever they've determined whether the family has religious issues or anything else. I do think there's a lot of benefits to birth control for women, and obviously I can't explain them all, but I will take the word for other testimonies. To hold back and not allow people, especially in Alaska or other resource states where we are out in the field, and there's a lot of women that are moving up into commercial fishing vessels and running their own or all kinds of different things. I think that the past of trying to hold on to this and the direction that we're going with the younger generation and whatnot, it's a fact, you know, people like sex, and so why not have them be prepared? Why be scared of the issue? Let them know their options. Let them make their own choices between religious or whatever, because who knows what's happening when they leave the home and they don't have the right programs or the right information in front of them. So again, I am in support of 345, and I do hope this passes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Elizabeth? Welcome, and next we will have Christine Nemi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you everyone for being here. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Figus, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself today. So I'm a Juneau resident and a PhD candidate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks now, but I appreciate the previous testimony because during the summer months, I now captain a troll tender based out of Sitka. And during those summers, when I and many other people are in remoter locations than their normal environment in Alaska, my crew members and I don't have much time to get to the doctor. And whatever kind of doctor appointment that is, we're working 7 days a week, and five out of those 7 days we're away from port. And so you might imagine during those 2 days that we're in port, we don't really have a lot of time, and it's not necessarily during business hours. So in the past, I've had to cancel different types of doctor appointments repeatedly, which is frustrating not only for us, but also financially taxing on the Sitka health providers. But we also have had to delay departures in order to get crucial care that's unavoidable for myself and my crew. And so some of these things are unavoidable, obviously. But I think that having to alter the schedule of not only our vessel and our crew, but also a tour fleet in Southern Chatham that works really hard for something so trivial as a pre-approved prescription pickup is simply silly and unnecessary as an expense. And so I'd like you guys to think a little bit about how this will save not only individual women, but also fishermen around Alaska money and time, and help deter all those costs about unplanned pregnancies and everything that we've talked about a lot today. And I also urge everyone to think a little bit about the fact that we're not here to argue about whether or not women should have contraception that's already legal. We're just here to think about how to make the system work more fiscally efficiently, in my opinion, on this bill. So please vote yes on House Bill 345 as the fiscally responsible choice. So thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. And Christine? Welcome. Would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your two-minute testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Seaton and committee members. I'm representing the League of Women Voters from Alaska, and the League of Women Voters of Alaska strongly supports House Bill 345, a bill related to insurance coverage for contraceptives and other services that reduce the risk of unintended pregnancies. At the national level, the League of Women Voters of the United States supports primary care for all, care that includes prenatal and reproductive health when women have the consistent ability to plan their pregnancies, their families benefit through greater financial well-being, healthier living conditions, healthier children, greater opportunities, and a myriad of other additional benefits. I'll skip some of this and we'll turn it in as testimony so we can go on with others.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Just one final comment. House Bill 345 can assist women and families to plan pregnancies so they are ready for the added responsibility of a child. In addition, costs to the state for unintended pregnancies can be reduced. This is a win-win bill that deserves consideration by the legislature, especially as it struggles with the budget crisis. Thank you for your consideration.
And thank you very much for your testimony. And now we will go to...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr, do you have a question?
She just had only said her first name, I believe, and then said she was on behalf of League of Women Voters. I don't know if that matters or not, if we should need to have her put her full name on the record.
Did you get her full name on the record? Christine? Nini. Nini, okay. Great. Let's go to Allison Curry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Allison Curry. I'm a resident of Juneau, and I represent Planned Parenthood Votes Northwest in Hawaii. And I am also testifying today in support of insurance coverage for 12-month supply of birth control when prescribed by a healthcare provider. I just want to say that I appreciate all the personal testimony that was given before me, and I agree with the points that were made. The only additional stats that I would like to add on this issue is that one in four women say that they have missed pills because they could not get the next pack in time, just to really highlight that this is a common issue for women. And consistent use of birth control is the best way to prevent unintended pregnancy for those who are sexually active, and getting a one-year supply dramatically improves consistent use. In addition to the stat from the study and published by Obstetrics and Gynecology that there's a 30% reduction in unintended pregnancy when a 12-month supply of birth control is dispensed, this is also associated with a 46% drop in the chance of needing an abortion, which is, I believe, a goal for everyone. So I would like to end by thanking Rep. Clayman, as well as the co-sponsors of this bill, for their leadership on this initiative, and I hope you all support this bill.
Thank you very much. And let's go to Samantha Savage in Fairbanks. Are you there, Samantha?
I am here. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Samantha Savage, and I live in House District 5, and I represent myself. I am testifying today to encourage you to support House Bill 345. For many women, oral contraception is their method of choice. For various personal medical reasons, Alaskan women face more barriers trying to access all medications due to geographic and occupational reasons. Speaking from my own life as someone who has needed oral contraceptives and has had to take time off work to go to the doctor and jump through hoops to get my prescription refilled, I wholeheartedly support this bill. If I can share a personal story, when I left the Mapsi Valley to attend the University of Alaska Fairbanks, trying to get my prescription refilled was an incredible burden, as I was transitioning from working full-time to going to school while also working. For me, going to a doctor's office was not financially realistic for me at the time, and I had to go without at the end of my one-month supply until I was able to get back on my feet. Having the ability to have 12 months of birth control covered by an insurance plan and Medicaid at one time saves in costs related to doctor's visits to the women seeking the medication, and it saves money related to unintended pregnancy. I urge you to support this bill as it would have a positive impact on many lives of Alaskan women. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else online to testify? Is there anyone else in the room to testify?
One more in the Anchorage LIO.
Neil? Thank you for letting us know. Catalin Hedberg, I believe it is. Would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and go ahead with your two-minute testimony, please?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. My name is Caitlin Hedberg, and I am I reside in Anchorage, Alaska. And thank you very much, Chairman and members of the committee, for hearing testimony on this bill today. I strongly second many of the issues and suggestions that have been brought forth in testimony thus far. And I, as well, I too support and urge you to support House Bill 345. I'm going to keep it short and sweet, but I basically wanted to provide some testimony from someone who can just speak to what it's like to be a professional woman who travels very often for work, and the burden that refilling birth control as often as my insurance company requires me to, the burden that places on me now, and also the burden that has placed on me in the past as a student, someone who studied global affairs and traveled a lot internationally. A couple of points I wanted to bring out to you specifically. I am one in the, you heard the statistic earlier, of one in four women who miss a pill because of lack of access to birth control. I am one of those folks, and there are two points I wanted to make as one of those women. The first is that we've talked about myriad reasons that birth control is prescribed to folks to treat certain medical conditions. But I don't know if anyone has brought up so far the way that missing a pill or having to start a new cycle because you've had an interruption in your access wreaks havoc on the human body. It is a significant experience for a woman to stop pills, have a gap in being able to access those medicines, and then to reintroduce them in her body. And I wanted to take that seriously as well. I also happen to be a person who experienced an unintended pregnancy because of lack of access to birth control. I was living on the Kenai Peninsula at the time and did not have adequate transportation for various reasons, was delayed in accessing the next cycle, and experienced that. Fortunately, I had a spontaneous miscarriage and I didn't have to make any tough choices, but I am one of those women that experienced an unintended pregnancy because of lack of access to birth control. Since my insurance company would only provide, I believe it was only 1 month at the time. So in conclusion, I just wanted to say, while we have talked about the fact that this is a fiscally responsible choice for the state of Alaska, I also want to just strongly mention that this is also a fiscally responsible choice for the women of our state. It allows us to utilize our time most effectively and eliminates the waste of time and difficult health outcomes that often come with interruption in access to birth control. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your testimony. And do we have anyone else in the audience here? I believe we have one person, Maxine Dugan, I believe. Would you identify yourself, your name, and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your two-minute testimony.
Yes, thanks. My name is Maxine Dugan, and I represent the Community United for Safety and Protection. We are Alaska sex worker group representing current and former sex workers, sex trafficking victims, and our allies. And we are speaking in support of this bill today. We urge the committee members to support it. We see this issue as very important to be able to expand access to health care for many people in Alaska, and then it has some fiscal implications, as the former speaker just said, and so we urge your support. Thanks.
And thank you for your testimony. Was there anyone else in the room? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and we have the bill back before the committee. Are there further questions that anyone has? Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions. I do support the bill, first of all, and I think it's a it just totally makes sense. I guess I just want to understand exactly what it does, because some of the testimonies were, is this more of an insurance bill, or is it that prior to this, could someone get a 12-month prescription for birth control pills, go to the pharmacy, say I have 12 months, grab all 12 months, and leave, and that insurance wouldn't cover it all? Or can that not be prescribed that way?
And would you identify yourself again on the record?
Of course. For the record, this is Megan Kavanaugh, staff to Representative Klayman. Through the chair, Representative Wool, it is my belief that they are not able to do that right now. So they cannot get 12 months at one time due to their prescription right now. It's either, depending on how your private insurer plan works, you can either get 1 month or 3 months of that prescriptive contraceptive. And I think, through the chair, Representative Wool, again, I think you're mostly referring to oral contraceptives, the pill, in that respect. But, yeah.
Okay.
Representative Wool.
So this is an insurance, the current state of insurance regulations won't allow someone to get more than 3 months, mm-hmm. or won't cover the payment for more than 3 months. I mean, insurance doesn't prescribe medication, it just pays for it. So, I'm supportive of this, so I'm not trying to...
Representative Will, maybe we should go to Margaret Brody. She may have a better or legislative legal. I think Margaret Brody... Margaret, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, at least for Medicaid, can you tell us how that works as far as duration of prescription?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For Medicaid, the prescription, depending on the age, is on a month-by-month basis, with individuals under the age of 18 being able to get up to 3 months prescribed.
So if we pass this bill, will that change that situation?
Mr. Chair, it would change the situation in that we would be able to go ahead and fill the prescription and Medicaid would pay, but on the back end, we'd have to go look and be sure that that individual was eligible for all 12 of those months. And if they weren't eligible for all 12 of those months, we would have to reimburse the federal government their share of that prescription for the months that they were not eligible.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wool, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess for Medicaid recipients. And this is for...
And Margaret, do you know if private insurance is the same way, that there's a limitation on the duration that can be prescribed?
Mr. Chair, private insurance, depending on the plan, is either 1 month or 3 months at a time.
Okay, thank you very much.
And one last,
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question. On the fiscal note analysis, benefit savings, it talks about the difference between a 9% failure rate and a 7% failure rate, having to do with people not having pills available. And the difference would be the number of unintended pregnancies of 120. And then it says, of those, complicated births are 4.4%, or approximately 5.28 unintended pregnancies would have complicated births. I guess that's assuming that all 120 unintended pregnancies result in childbirth, which I think is probably not accurate. I mean, many people get pregnant and quite often miscarry, just normal. So I'm not sure of 120 unintended pregnancies is 120 births, but so I don't know if that analysis is exactly accurate. But
and that would be for Margaret Brody, I think, on the fiscal note.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Margaret, did you hear that question? And that was not on version A. We're looking at the draft for the Senate bill, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I did hear the question, and I I agree that if there are 120 unintended pregnancies, they would not all result in a live birth. Okay. And I believe that we have taken that into consideration with our calculations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does anyone have any other questions on the bill at this time? We're going to set it aside. We have scheduled a special meeting for tomorrow at 3:30, at which we will consider the bill again, as well as the other bill that we have before us. So we can probably try and figure out with the director between now and then how to answer that, you know, how those calculations were made. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just hope that we do take it up as early as possible and can try and move it along. This is an area where I've worked for probably almost 20 years now, and it's just a long-standing problem with access. And one of the groups we didn't hear from are young families, and you know, those are the folks that I dealt with regularly who were very challenged in balancing the demands of being a new parent as well as getting back to work, and you know, basically your own personal needs always get pushed aside in a circumstance like that. And this, I think, could be very beneficial to those young families who are really in a place where they do want to be planning their families because they're, you know, have young ones already. And I hope we can take this up pretty quick and move it along.
I hope you'll be available at 3:30 tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Did you have one?
Okay. Say thank you.
Thank you, Representative Klayman, for bringing us the bill. We will be addressing it tomorrow, and we will recess our meeting today and take it up in the continued meeting starting at 3:30 tomorrow. So I'm going to remove my objection to the CS. So the Is there any further objection to the CS? Seeing none, the CS version H has been adopted as our working document, and we're now going to go to House Bill 3. Where are we? Three. Brief of these. C-34, Child Custody, Domestic Violence, and Child Abuse. And Representative Munoz's staff has come forward. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then tell us what version we are looking at.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Munoz. She does send her regards. She is up in House Finance right now. As of a result of the last couple meetings that we've had on House Bill 334, between the public testimony and the committee discussion, we have since been working with all parties and legislative legal to try and find some common ground on this piece of legislation. We heard the committee loud and clear. There was the recommendation of clear and convincing evidence, and then also a possible tightening up of the definition of domestic violence, or kind of, you know, where we go from here. About 5 minutes ago, I did receive a draft from legislative legal that I will be providing to you and your staff at the conclusion of this meeting, allowing you time to go through the CS. See if there's any changes that you would like to see.
Okay. Let me just ask the committee. Let's see, we could. We'll take a brief at ease. Good. At our last meeting, we were in public testimony, and we had a communications failure. We couldn't understand the remaining two members in public testimony. So I'm going to reopen the public testimony. And so to get that public testimony in. So that would be Keely Olson. Are you online there, Keely?
Yes, you do, sir.
Great. Would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes. Thank you to the chair and members of the committee. My name is Keely Olson, and I am testifying as the executive director for STAR in Anchorage, Standing Together Against Rape, you may know it. I've worked as a professional advocate for victims for over 20 years in three different states, primarily specializing in domestic violence and sexual assault during that time. I started managing a domestic violence shelter in 1989 in Missoula, Montana, and have worked as a domestic violence advocate in prosecuting attorney's office in Olympia, Washington for 6 years, as well as being involved in numerous works throughout the states where I've lived. I've also been noted as an expert witness in three states, Montana, Washington, and Alaska, in regards to domestic violence. I am testifying in opposition to this bill because I think that it rolls us back in time to not provide the kind of protections for victims of domestic violence and their children that we are fully capable of providing. I have witnessed hundreds of criminal domestic violence trials in my position as an advocate working at a prosecuting attorney's office, and I believe as a result of seeing that the requirement for a criminal conviction is too high a standard to be placed on victims of domestic violence when they are seeking protections through civil legal protections and through family court to protect them and their children. I think anyone who has worked in the field of domestic violence, as long as I have lost people that they've worked with through homicide, generally that has occurred through the exchange, a set-up exchange of children for custody arrangements that have been set through for the court, and I believe that the rebuttal presumption is a very effective tool to protect the safety of victims and their children. I think a lot of the testimony that I heard from attorneys last week were complaints that it created havoc in the family law courts, and that this wasn't as efficient as it could be. Well, domestic violence is a messy business, and there are a lot of reasons that it is one of the most underreported crimes in America, and oftentimes when victims of domestic violence are harmed in their relationships, they blame themselves. They are still very much in love with their abusive partners. They are not going to, we're not going to see an increase in criminal law convictions as a result of this move. We're just going to be telling the court that they should turn a blind eye to an abusive history in their courtrooms. And I don't feel that, requiring a conviction offers any protections to the victims and their children. I would state that if you were to think of the worst form of torture imaginable, it would be having to observe someone you love being harmed in front of you and being powerless to stop it. And that is the real situation of the children in abusive homes. And so even if a parent is not harming their child directly, the child is still feeling the harmful effects of the domestic violence. I think that when hearing testimony on this bill, that you need to be extremely cautious and you need to properly vet when people are claiming to be experts because they've handled a few family law cases, as opposed to someone who has really devoted their career to working in the field and understanding the dynamics of domestic abuse. One of the hallmarks being a very quick honeymoon type of relationship that results in a pregnancy. That being because the abuser knows that once he has a child with that victim, he will or she will always have their hooks in the victim through the child. That person will never be able to completely escape or flee the situation because they will be constrained by what the court orders as far as custody. And if the court is going to take the issue of custody on, then they need to be prepared to be able to hear some of the messy business that goes on behind closed doors. That is the typical situation of domestic abuse.
Okay,
thank you very much for opposing this bill.
Thank you, Keely. And just so everyone's aware, the CS that we have has changed the standard so that the court finds by clear and convincing evidence that there's a history of performing domestic violence. It is a change in standard in the proposed CS instead of conviction. So I know it's difficult when they're changing CSs and people are testifying, but I wanted to make sure that you were aware that we and the sponsor are listening, and there's revisions being made. So thank you again, and let's go to Christine Pate. Christine Pate, are you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am the legal program director with the Alaska Network on the domestic violence and sexual assault, and I am in opposition, as is our agency, to House Bill 334. Our legal program provides civil legal assistance, primarily in family law cases, to victims of DV and SA statewide. Additionally, I provide legal advice and counsel to advocates at our 23-member programs and affiliates who work with victims and their children daily in legal proceedings. I've been practicing family law since 1994, and I've worked with thousands of victims of domestic violence and sexual assault who are litigating through the custody process. I very well understand how the custody statutes affect victims both prior to the 2004 amendments to the law, which created the rebuttable presumption, and since that law was enacted. ANSA has grave concerns about how this proposed legislation will affect children growing up in homes with DV. The current custody law, the rebuttable presumption, was enacted to protect Alaska children from the harmful effects of exposure to domestic violence. ANSA wholeheartedly agrees with the sponsor, Representative Kathy Muniz's statement that fathers are a critical part of a child's lives. But what is most important for a child is having two healthy parents, and in homes where there's been DV, that is sadly not possible. Our state consistently ranks in the top rates for DV and sexual assault nationwide, and we know that children who grow up in homes with domestic abuse are at grave risk for being directly abused themselves. Additionally, when children witness violence in their homes, they are at risk that they will be killed or injured by the violence, and that their emotional, physical, and mental health will be detrimentally affected. The rebuttable presumption against awarding a parent joint or sole custody was enacted to ensure that courts made consideration of domestic violence a top priority in deciding custody of children. Prior to the enactment of this law, DV was one of 9 best interest factors that the court could consider in deciding whether to award custody to a parent. What attorneys, victims, and victims' advocates told the legislature in 2004 was that the system was broken for families plagued by violence. The 2004 legislature heard testimony about victims and children who had been killed by abusers during custody cases. Given the enormity of the problem in our state, making DV one of 9 best interest factors was not adequate protection for Alaskan children in custody matters. Courts sometimes fail to hear evidence of DV, minimize the importance of it, or fail to put in place rehabilitative programs for a parent who had committed domestic violence. House Bill 334 would bring us back to that statutory framework by only allowing the court to consider DV as one of 9 best interest factors unless there's been a criminal conviction for DV. Now, I understand that there has been a substitution, and let me just speak briefly about my concerns about a clear and convincing evidence standard. I believe that domestic violence, as you just heard from Ms. Olson, is incredibly hard to prove. It's a messy business proving in court. Victims often don't want to come forward because of fear or shame. There often is not a lot of extraneous evidence of the domestic violence. Many of these cases can turn on he said, she said, and we rely upon our courts, who are in the business of determining credibility, to decide who is correct. If you make this a clear and convincing evidence standard, It makes domestic violence harder to prove than anything else in a custody case, which makes absolutely no sense given the enormous problem we have in our state. I am glad to hear that the criminal conviction standard is being taken out, because I think that is an enormous burden for victims to be able to overcome, especially in rural Alaska. Respectfully, I would like to point out some misperceptions of the current law that has been brought out in written or oral testimony presented to this committee. First, there's nothing in the legislative history of the rebuttable presumption law that indicates that its purpose was to require a criminal history of DV. The current law requires a history of perpetrating domestic violence to invoke the rebuttable presumption, which is defined as one act which causes serious physical injury, which is a very high standard to meet, or more than one act of domestic violence, found by a preponderance of the evidence, 51% or more, but the civil legal standard. And contrary to what one speaker said before, the history of domestic violence is well defined in the statute. Second, merely being accused of domestic violence is not enough to invoke the presumption and lose custody of your children. There has to be a finding by the trial court after full notice and opportunity to be heard by both sides that it is more likely than not, again, the civil legal standard, that one incident of serious physical injury or two or more incidents occurred. This finding cannot happen in an ex parte protection order hearing, but it could only occur after a long-term domestic violence hearing or in a custody case where both parties had a chance to fully present evidence and testify about the incidents. Please note that domestic violence protection order hearings in many places turn into mini trials. They can go on for days, so these are not expedited hearings where parties are not being allowed to present their information.
Christine, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your testimony, please.
Sure. That courts make findings of domestic violence in long-term protection order cases because they understand they are hesitant to make findings in long-term protection order hearings because they understand the significance that the finding has in a custody case. And let me just hit on one other point that I've heard made by several speakers, which is the high cost of supervised visitation or doing a batterers program around the state.
We don't have time for the debate to go back and forth, so I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your testimony. You can send emails, testimony to the committee and to the individual members as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have put in written testimony, and supervised visitation is free in most places in this state. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, and I want to let everyone online and in the room know that if this bill passes out of committee, it next goes to the Judiciary Committee, where many of these arguments are more properly understood and made. So we will now have this back before the committee. We have available for questions Nancy Mead from the courts, Linda Bruce. Oh, and that was our two members of the public that were electronically cut off, and we had a public testimony before, so I'm going to close public testimony, reclose it. And we have Linda Bruce from Ledge Legal and Margaret Bodie from DHSS. So we can have Ms. Representative Munoz's staff come back up again. Oh, and Nancy is here in the room, so there may be questions for you as well. So why don't you come on up. And Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the real struggle for this bill in my evaluation here is that the testimony has been in conflict with each other, just people saying this sort of extreme happens and people saying this extreme is what happens, and not extreme in the sense of the application of of the policy necessarily, but just in how they're describing them are exact opposite of each other. And I guess if Nancy has anything to add to that, the last point I would just say, the supervised visits, for example, just taking that single issue, we've had people say it's not available. It's very costly, $75 an hour. There aren't organizations to do it, you know, which makes the whole circumstance that leads to that situation be problematic. The last speaker just said in most communities, supervised visits are free. Can you help make sense of some of those things that have just been, you know, completely opposite of each other?
And we're going to go ahead and have Nancy answer that question, but then we're going to go back to the sponsor because we have a new CS.
Oh, I apologize. We can wait then, Mr. Chairman.
If we can wait, that would be better. So,
okay.
You want to adopt it?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 334. That would be version 29-LS1409/N as the working document.
Okay, thank you. And we have that work. Is there an objection to adopting this as a working document? So would you put yourself back on record and then go ahead and reintroduce this bill to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Crystal Keenum and staff to Representative Munoz. House Bill 334, as we've discussed, is a complicated issue. Representative Tarr, you're right. You know, we've heard both sides of the spectrum, you know, and we've heard that as well. And so what we're trying to do is seek a way to find more of a middle ground for both the victims and those that are caught in the system for the best interest of the children. That's what we're after. Through the meetings, it kind of set me on a path to go back and do a lot of research on this. Mr. Chairman, if I may, before we get to the CS, I went back to the original language that was established back in 1981, and there's intent language that was adopted by the legislature, and I just wanted to get that on the record if it's not too long. Essentially what it says is that the legislature finds that it's in the best interest for parents to share the rights and responsibilities of child rearing. While actual physical custody may not be practical or appropriate in all cases, it is the intent of the legislature that both parents have the opportunity to guide and nurture their child and to meet the needs of the children on an equal footing beyond the considerations of support or actual custody. And that's what we're seeking to do, to make sure that the needs of the child is met. With the CS, I can go through the changes that were incorporated, or we can speak more generally, whichever the committee prefers.
Does the committee want to see the changes, or should we? You want to see? Okay, go through the changes, please.
All right, and this is, like I said, I received this not too long ago as well, so I'm doing my first cursory read of this as well. Section 1, 2520.060A removes the rebuttable presumption language that was in 2524.150G. We'll get more into that in later subsections. Section 2 of the bill deals with visitation and proceedings involving domestic violence. It adds in language stating that clear and convincing evidence to establish a history of perpetrating domestic violence. It also has the language for the conviction of a crime. So both of those factors the judge is able to use in determining visitation rights.
So just to be clear, there's an or there, so it's either or, it's not both.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, it is either or.
Okay.
The rest of that language included in 060 was current statutory language. Section 3 of the bill regarding temporary custody of the child, again, the rebuttable presumption language is removed, as is in Section 4. This is dealing with military families, and if a deployed parent is wanting visitation rights to be delegated to a family member. Section 5 is modification of a custody or visitation order that removes the rebuttable presumption. Again, Section 6 removes the rebuttable presumption language, and for military families wishing to have their visitations delegated to another family member. Section 7 of the bill is AS 2524-150C, which has been the brunt of the issue. Through this CS, subsection C, sub 6, changes the language to clear and convincing evidence. So it removes the current language in 6. That states if there's a willingness and ability of each parent to facilitate and encourage a close continuing relationship, but that may not be considered if there has been any domestic violence. So that section has been reworked, and then it's renumbered. Section 8 of the bill is really where a lot of the changes are made. This is all new language that wasn't contained in original 334, nor is it in current statute. What this section does is it brings all of the custody arrangements back to AS 2520-061 if there is any clear and convincing evidence of domestic violence. And that language is set out in Section 2 of the bill. So instead of having the rebuttable presumption in place, the court may order 8 separate pieces, and I can walk through those in more detail. They are set out in Section 2, as I mentioned.
So, are we on Section 8 on sub M?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
One of the main provisions that's contained in, because it says in sub M, that if the court finds by clear and convincing evidence that a parent has a history of perpetrating domestic violence, or if the parent has been convicted of a crime against domestic violence, against the parent or a child of the two parents within the 5 years preceding the award of visitation, the court may set conditions for visitation under 2520061. And that was one of the conversations that we had in earlier committees, was whether or not there should be a time frame around any of these acts of domestic violence, and whether or not you could apply something that happened 25 years ago and rehash that from a prior relationship where neither, where the other parent and the child were not in that situation. Sub N of Section 8 talks about if both parents have committed a crime against domestic violence against the other parent or a child of the two parents within a 5 year 5 years preceding, and the sub 1 and sub 2 are a carryover of current statute language. So they would award custody to the parent who is least likely to continue to perpetrate domestic violence, or award custody to a suitable third party if ordered by the court. Section 9 of the bill repeals the rebuttable presumption language, as well as the language around if both parents had committed a crime against domestic violence. And then Section 10 of the bill states that this act only applies to visitation or custody orders issued on or after the effective date of this bill. And I'm very happy to go into more.
Okay, thank you. And I guess one of the questions on page 5 there under M, or a child of the two parents, oftentimes, I think in these situations, there's parents that are coming in that had children. Is this language here meaning that it wouldn't be applicable if it was a child of either mm-hmm. one of the parents? Mm-hmm. And do we need to get that revised so it's a child within the family or some such similar language? I'm not the legal expert. I'm just trying to figure out the family situations.
Mr. Chairman, our intent with the CS was that it would apply to, if there are stepchildren or foster children that are in the home. I know it was, we worked very closely with legal and they were, there was a couple iterations of this, and so we were trying to get this to the committee by today's hearing. I don't know, Linda Bruce is online, I believe, and she may be able to address that.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wohl.
Are we trying to say a child of either of the two parents?
Well,
is it that simple?
Thank you. I think let's go to Ledge Legal because we, there could be foster kids. There could be, I don't know what a child of the parent is. It could be children. Then it wouldn't be really a child of the parent. So it's a child within the family, I think, is what we're talking about. But I don't know about the legality. So Linda Bruce, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
You've heard our discussion here?
Yes.
Is there some way that you could craft this language to take care of the situation of any child that was within the family, that it would apply to them instead of just of the two parents?
Mr. Chairman, that language currently exists under 2520061. That is, I believe, where that was pulled from. However, we could alter it to apply to a child of either of the two parents.
Okay, and would that cover foster children in the home?
Mr. Chairman, if we altered the language to be a child of either of the two parents, then I believe it would, but I might have to look into that further and I could provide a written response.
Okay, if you could do that. And we have Nancy Mead of the courts here. Do you have anything to add on this at this time?
For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. On that fact, I guess I'd defer to Ledge Legal on exactly how to word it. I know that in the definitions of domestic violence and household member, they do already have definitions set out for what's a household member, so I'm sure that is something that could be worked out pretty readily.
So that could be a household member or something like that. So,
perhaps.
Representative Vasquez.
I think there's a definition of child in the adoption chapter. That's 25.23.240. Quote, child means a son or daughter whether by birth or by adoption. The problem I have personally with this, that's very restricted. What if you have a child that technically is not a biological child and has yet to be adopted? I mean, technically they would not be covered. So something like household member would be more appropriate, because that could include an aunt that's living within the house as a member of the household, or a grandmother or uncle.
And Linda, can you, or Ms. Bruce, can you look at solving that problem for us so that so it's covering domestic violence that would be within the household?
Mr. Chairman, I can.
Okay, great. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering what happens in a circumstance where, two adults have a blended family, each have biological children from previous relationships, but they do not become legally married. Is there a certain amount of time that passes to where, one of, even though there's not a legal marriage, what would have been the step-parent, if they had been legally married, does that person ever have any legal, custody or visitation rights? Sort of, I'm thinking of, common law marriage or something, after a certain period of time for purposes of legal proceedings, I think that, an asset distribution and things like that, the courts would consider the couples like a married couple, because they've been similarly situated for some period of time. But does a circumstance like that exist for purposes of visitation or custody rights?
through the chair, Representative Tarr, I'll take a shot at that. I have to confess that I'm not positive, and that's a good question. I know that there are grandparents' rights when it comes to child custody cases, and there are obviously parental rights. I've not really heard of actual rights for other persons, even with a longstanding relationship with the child, but I can look that up and get back to you, and I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. And I think that, you know, if we do decide to move this bill from committee, I think that it would be good to have a letter outlining questions that we have for the you know, the next committee, because we're beyond our level of expertise in some of these areas. I mean, we're, you know, we definitely want to protect the child and all, but when we get into the detailed legal questions, I think that's probably better to ask the next committee to raise those and answer those questions. So just giving another mechanism other than trying to amend something from our knowledge base. Representative Tarr, did you have another?
No, Mr. Chairman, does it have a Judiciary Committee referral?
Yes.
It does, okay. I just am thinking of, you know, working with the school principals in my area and talking about the complexities of some of the families and, you know, because people don't always follow through with the legal, you know, either legally setting up, you know, custodial, who the custodial parent is, or visitation. You know, I've seen that with OCS cases, and then also, you know, just not legally getting married. So those circumstances, that if they could address those, I think those would be, you know, good to put some thought into.
And what we can do is look at if the members will get questions to us, we can draft a letter to accompany the bill asking the Judiciary Committee to address those issues. Is there any more on this particular point? Let's go to page 4, lines 11 and 14. I'm trying to figure out the explanation for here having a family member, for a deployed parent being convicted of a crime and removing history of perpetrating domestic violence.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is Crystal Keenum and staff to Representative Munoz. That was the very first note I wrote when I was going through this CS, that I do believe that language should also be conforming to the clear and convincing evidence or has committed a crime. So it's consistent in all areas.
Okay, and so we will send a note, Ms. Bruce, where obviously we're going to have some redrafting. Are there other questions on particulars of the bill or how it's set out? Representative Tarr had a question, and Ms. Mead, you were going to answer that, and we interrupted by finding out what CS we had.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I believe you had a question about supervised visitation and its availability in different communities. And the honest answer to that is I've heard different things. Usually with supervised visitation, the most common thing that happens is the judge seeks to have the parties agree on a family friend or relative who can supervise the visitation. And that nearly always works because the judge strongly encourages it, and if the parties are really not able to agree on somebody to supervise, will they have to go to a professional supervised visitation, a nonprofit center or something, which does charge a fee, and that's usually enough to get the parties to agree on somebody, a friend who will supervise the visitation. As to its availability in different communities, I did hear information that in Juneau there was an entity that did it that's no longer doing it, and I heard the testimony from the last public testifier who believed that there was supervised visitation in most places. My information from Anchorage is that there was a place, and frankly the judges weren't certain if they were doing it anymore, because they really nearly always get the parties to agree on a friend, and the people don't have to pay for visitation. That's what I know about that, and I'll look into that a little bit more also for the Judiciary Committee. I guess it varies by community.
Okay, thank you. Did you have something to add to that question? Are there further questions that we have about this that we would like to get resolved? So I think that...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another issue that has come up is the issue of the participation in a batter intervention program. If the budget goes through the way it was written as it passed the House, and I believe the same is true in the Senate right now, the only batter intervention programs that will be left will be the prison-based batter interventions. The only ones we know with certainty will be left will be prison-based, because the funding for the community-based programs is being eliminated. I'm told that in some communities, using Juneau as an example, the city and borough of Juneau, you know, picked up a portion of the cost for the community-based program. So you can't say with certainty the program will be eliminated, because it's unclear whether the community will have some means to, you know, pick up that service. I don't have information about many other communities, but I also know that the statute says that the judge can't order that if there's not a program within 50 miles, as it's been described to me, and if I'm getting that wrong, please let me know. So that seems to be a piece of how some of these issues would be resolved, is that the individual, you know, who perpetrated the crime would have to participate in that batter intervention program that then would, you know, lead to different visitation rights. So, you know, we're just given this sort of everything in flux. I mean, can you give sort of any insight into how that might impact the ability of these situations to sort of be resolved favorably?
And you're not asking her to tell us which form of the budget will pass, are you?
No, definitely not,
thankfully. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, and I just got this work draft as well, but the way I read the work draft is, in Section 9, the presumption is eliminated from 2524.150. That would be subsection G has the presumption in it now. There's no longer the presumption, and subsection H, also repealed by this bill, was the provision, or is currently the provision, that says to rebut the presumption you need to go to one of those batterers intervention programs. Mm-hmm. That would no longer be in the bill. However, if you look at page 2 of the bill, lines 8 through 12, and other provisions of the bill relate back to that, if there is a finding by clear and convincing evidence that there's domestic violence or a conviction of domestic violence, one of the things the court may, that's in line 3, order, is that the perpetrator go to one of those programs. And I guess I'd just say, as a matter of logistics, if a program didn't exist, I wouldn't expect a judge to order somebody to go into one. So that could still remain in the statute in case they exist, or in places where they do, as an option, but it wouldn't be ordered if it isn't available. So I don't think that's a flaw in this draft of the bill, at least.
Okay. And I guess I had a question. We, in another bill that we were looking at, we found that the behavioral health, telehealth, actually had better results because they had more full attendance. Is there a batterer program offered electronically? Do we know that?
Mr. Chairman,
identify yourself again.
This is Crystal Keenum, and staff to Representative Munoz. In my digging on the batterers program, along the vein that Representative Tarr was, you know, trying to figure out where in the state it was offered, I did find out that there are online batterer prevention programs, but they are not used in this state. Because they are new, it just hasn't been an avenue that we've delved into, but they are available online.
Oh, good. Okay. Any further comments? We're going to... Nancy, did you have anything else?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to set this bill aside, and we're going to go on to the next bill. Let's take a brief at ease. Have this bill with the suggestions that have been made redrafted as a CS, and we will have it before the committee at the 3:30 extension of the meeting that will be 3:30 tomorrow. We will not have public testimony. We're going to be considering the bill, committee discussion. If the bill moves from the committee, and that will be by the will of the committee, then it would go on to judiciary, where many of these, the technical judiciary kind of questions would be addressed beyond those that we've been able to identify at this point. But that will depend on the desires of the committee. So that's what we're setting this bill aside at this time, and we will take up House Bill 315, and we'll take just a brief at ease. We're back on the record and House Hess, and it is about 4:32. Oh, that's right. That clock's wrong anyway, isn't it? We are going to take up now House Bill 315, electronic visit verification. And Representative,
yeah,
do you have
this? I can move it.
Okay. Good.
The CS?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that the committee adopts the CS for HB 315, Work Draft 29-LS1287, /N, N as in Nancy, as the working document.
And I will object for discussion, and my staff will give us the presentation on the CS.
For the record, my name is Tanika Hansen, Staff to Representative Seaton. So the original bill was to establish an electronic visit verification system. The CS narrows the approach for the first couple years by directing the department to establish a pilot project or projects of electronic visit verification systems. Section 1 is legislative intent language, stating that it's the intent of the legislature to protect vulnerable Alaskans and the integrity of the medical assistance program by reducing the number of fraudulent claims and ensuring that services are provided to medical recipients, and to use technology to improve accountability for personal care services and home and community-based services delivered to medical assistance recipients. And Section 2 is uncodified law, as this is a short pilot project. So Section 2 establishes the pilot project. It directs the department to adopt standards for an electronic visit verification system under the project, and the system would be used to verify visits conducted to provide personal care services in the home or other settings, and visits conducted to provide home and community-based services. And they should establish the providers who are eligible to participate, and they will require that the electronic visit verification system will document, at a minimum, the name of the provider or their employee who's providing the services, the recipient's name, the date and time the employee or contractor begins and ends the delivery of services, and location of services. These are similar to the four data points collected by the previous CS, with a little bit of change to specify that they would document the name of the provider and the employee or contractor in the case of a provider that's a personal care agency and they are not providing the service themselves. And then Section B would state that the department shall review the electronic visit verification system or systems implemented under this section and prepare a report making recommendations for statewide application of an electronic visit verification system. And that report in this draft would be due on or before January 1st of 2018, and would be delivered to the legislature. So that is the CS. We also have an amendment and a few conceptual amendments to just tighten up things.
And thank you. Are there questions about the CS? Seeing none, I will remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS?
I have a question.
Reverend Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the pilot program, is at the discretion of the department? Or, I mean, are they hiring a vendor, or are they doing it in-house, or does it matter?
The CS, and we have an amendment that will make it clear that they can hire a vendor or that they can use with one of the, we've got several of the PCA, personal care assistant organizations, that providers that are fairly large, that have systems themselves, that have an electronic box that can be turned on, an electronic part of their program that they're not currently using. And it may turn out that the department would have contract with one of them to do that as a pilot project with, you know, that's broad enough and big enough. It doesn't limit it to one project. It could be one rural, one urban. Or it could be, if we adopt the amendment, it could be a vendor, outside vendor, not one of those. So we're trying to make sure that the department has the flexibility to get something that will work, and that people are, you know, willing to participate in. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, the follow-up. I guess
Rep. Noble.
That makes sense. I just, obviously, if you're hiring a vendor, there's going to be an expense associated with that, and I don't know, and I can't recall if they get paid based on their savings. probably not. In other words,
we have the, I think we have a fiscal note, and we'll have Margaret Brody or Deb Etheridge should be online to thank my tablet here isn't telling me anything. So Deb Etheridge is in the room. Oh, okay. And do you want to address the, are you here to address the fiscal note?
Sure.
Okay. You may as well come forward. So, so we have a question on the fiscal note.
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the Deputy Director in Senior and Disability Services. Mr. Chair, I would like to get a little clarification on the fiscal note in which you're referencing, if that's a possibility.
That would be for version N of 315. That's the one that has the pilot projects. Do we have one that works with? No, I don't think so, do we? We don't have a fiscal note for Ann yet, I guess. Our drafts are on E. Was that the full program? Yeah, so we only have it on the fiscal note on the full program. We don't have the fiscal note yet on the narrower pilot project type model. Though on the, I believe in version E, there was the fiscal note had a fiscal note about the vendor, and in the details of estimates, though we don't know what that would be for a pilot project. I'm presuming, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I can speak to some of the anticipated costs that would translate potentially to the pilot.
And would you identify yourself first on the record there?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is Deb Etheridge, Deputy Director in Senior and Disability Services, for the record.
Thanks.
So to respond to questions about costs associated with the pilot project, the department would assume that we would have to have a statistically valid sample in order to have an effective pilot. And so we would I haven't calculated what that sample would be. However, we through consultation with Representative Vasquez's industry expert, we understand that, and with our consultation with other states such as Washington, Ohio, and Texas, the transaction fee per transaction is about 15 cents, and each visit is two transactions, so they equal 60 cents a transaction. And so it would depend upon the number of services a person receives in a day. If we were to institute the pilot project only for, let's as an example, personal care services and not home and community-based services, then we would have maybe less per-day transactions. A person can receive personal care services once, twice, three times a day. But then if you added home and community-based services, they may, let's say, in the morning receive personal care services, and then in the afternoon attend a day program or a day habilitation in their home, and then have a personal care in the evening. And so it depends on those transactions. And for the fiscal note, the draft fiscal note that was for the previous CS, we anticipated a cost associated with two visits a day for 5 days a week, 20 days a month. Or, yeah, 20 days a month, not 5 days a week, because that was a little bit higher.
And overall, that yielded a savings.
So through the chair, Mr. Chair, the savings are associated with a 1.5% efficiency we would find in administrative in claiming for Medicaid. The idea is that when a person actually calls in, we know, and calls out, we would have actual time associated with that, and so we would see a savings because there won't be a rounding of that, and so we would true up with the actual time that a person's receiving the care. And so we have estimated at least a 1.5% savings.
Okay, thank you. And I noticed in some of the background materials that the savings in a couple other states accrued in the first year, and then it tended to the providers adjusted.
Mr. Chair, that.
And so those savings kind of didn't continue.
Mr. Chair, that is true. In certain examples, in small populations, they've shown us considerable savings, and then when it rolled out on a statewide, it didn't reflect the savings. So the pilot is a nice way to ensure that we receive that.
So it would be large enough to be statistically significant, and
yes,
so that we would have a better idea that if we rolled it out in. And would you presume that if the pilot was being designed, it'd be designed for a couple of different kind of locations, so that, or maybe more than one pilot? How would that?
Mr. Chair, that's a good, we would have to do that. We would have to, some of the expenditures associated that we have a difficult time anticipating has to do with device when a person does not have connectivity, and so we have to pay for a solution, and that solution can, from the industry expert, was $7 per member per month for that solution. And so we would, I think, we would need to look at target different areas in the state of Alaska to ensure that we understood what our costs were and our, could realize the savings.
Okay, great. Representative Wolf, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like some of the savings are going to come from sort of fraud reduction. In other words, the state's getting billed for a service that isn't provided. But if this verification system works, then that will probably not happen so much, so that you can verify every visit, so no one's going to get billed for a visit that doesn't happen. And then once the system's in place, like you said, those savings kind of go away once people sort of start playing by the rules. Is that the expected sort of behavior?
Through the chair, what we expect is that we will see ongoing compliance with our and adherence to how they bill for services using the EVV system. And so we anticipate an overall reduction that is at, would be shown throughout the years. So we would anticipate that each year we would realize a savings because of ongoing compliance due to the electronic visit verification. Through the chair, the concern that Representative Seaton, I think, is raising is that some states, when they implemented their EVV system, didn't allocate enough funds to do what's considered a biologic. It's not biologic, but it's an actual, you can tell the presence of the person who's supposed to be providing the service in the home. And there is a solution to that that costs just a little bit extra funding, but if not implemented, we can't tell if the actual person's in the home. And so in some telephony solutions, they have realized how to kind of move around some of that verification, so it's not as valid. But the cost, of course, is higher, and you have to weigh the cost of implementing the solution to the cost of the Medicaid program. Any additional burden that the Medicaid program puts on the administrator of the service, we capture those administrative costs in their cost report, and then will eventually be reflected in an increase in their reimbursement. So we factor all of these in when we're implementing programs for the state.
One more follow-up.
Thank you. All right. Well, I mean, I guess on this statement here, it talks about fraud, criminal convictions for Medicaid fraud, 130 criminal convictions. So presumably, if you have a verification system, people can't say, oh, I went to see patient A, and please pay me for that, when they didn't even go. So that's the fraud we're trying to eliminate, and billing for stuff that they didn't do. So I guess with the verification, these people will actually be verified that they did go provide that care. So you're paying for the care still, but the person's actually receiving it. And then you talk about rounding. So when they're actually at someone's house, the time that they're there is accurately recorded, and so they're maybe getting paid. The services, which I assume are hourly, are more accurately recorded, so they can't say, oh, I was here for an hour when they're only there for 43 minutes or something like that. So it sounds like once the system is in place and operable, the costs will sort of stabilize. I would think if you eliminate fraud and you accurately account for how long people are providing care for it. I mean, unless there's other stuff that I'm not getting.
Through the chair. I just one correction. For some services, we do, most services are in a 15-minute unit that we authorize, and so there is, you know, that reflects a different type of data that we capture. And yes, we anticipate that we will see less people receive. We will see more people receiving the services in which they're authorized for. Well, everyone's entitled to the services they're authorized for. We're trying to stop and prevent people from billing for services in which they're not providing. But they still could provide those services because they are actually authorized for them.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions on the CS?
Just a general comment, Mr. Chairman. There's also a quality assurance component to this. If a provider, a home care taker, does not show up, the system will pick that up, or if they are late, and that's critical to the care of the recipient, that also will be picked up. So there's a real important quality assurance. In fact, Tennessee has put a premium on using this system to carefully monitor quality assurance. Other systems, Florida, for both purposes, but they saw first year $19 million in savings and $2.5 million the second year. Oklahoma, over a 2 or 3 year period, saw a $21 million savings. Obviously, it's not going to continue on after the first or second year because people then modify their behavior.
Yeah, which is good. However, what I want to do is see it. Representative Wohl had an objection to the adoption of the CS. We're having that discussion. I'm just trying to figure out.
Well, I guess my question relating to that would be, it sounds like it's a system that's needed based on these numbers. A pilot program, is that just to try it and see if it works? And then if it does, to implement a continual program? Or is that because, is that what that is for? Or is that because you'll realize the savings and then maybe you don't need the program anymore, but I would imagine you would need to continue to verify.
And Representative Wohl, the purpose of doing the pilot is so that we don't get into the kind of thing that we had with Xerox coming in, trying to do the whole system, trying to do the whole state, trying to solve all the problems at one time, and having something that all of a sudden crashes around, or, well, you don't have a small enough, you got enough problems in there that it, the verification doesn't work, and you've got this big system trying to cover the whole state. So the reason for having it is to find out, well, what works, and the purpose of having the department make sure that the data that comes in they can utilize to verify. And if they don't have those kinds of regulations or standards, then all of a sudden there's some data coming in, but if you can't use it to verify through Medicaid, we want to make sure that it's compliant so that we're fully able to utilize the data. So that's the purpose of doing it on small enough but large enough bite to be statistically significant to work out the chinks.
Sure.
Do you remove your objection?
I didn't have one, but I will remove it anyways.
Well, okay. Are there further questions on the CS before we move to the amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I can wait and make my comments after
okay.
We looked at the amendment.
Let's. I'd like to move amendment number N.5. That's to page 2, line 19, and that's inserting a subsection to read B, the Department of Health and Social Services may consider a third-party vendor system for the pilot project under this section, and then renumbering as needed. Do I have an objection to that amendment?
I object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, we have an objection. Representative Vasquez, would you like to speak to your objection?
No, I would support this amendment, Mr. Chairman. It it just provides the department with further flexibility in implementing this program. Thank you.
Do you maintain your objection?
No, is there? No, I remove my objection.
Is there a further objection to adopt an amendment number one? That's N.5. Seeing none, amendment number one, N.5, has been adopted. I would like to offer a conceptual amendment for page 2, line 7, and that is on the second to the last word there after after settings. Mm-hmm. We're replacing and with or. And I'll just explain why, and that is to provide more flexibility in the adoption of the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number one? Well, we better make that. Mr. Secretary, is that a problem if we're doing conceptual number one when we've done amendment number one? Okay, that's conceptual number amendment number one, replacing on page 2, line 7, and with or. So, seeing no objection, we've adopted conceptual amendment number one. And I think, Butch, did I have an objection to the CS?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm going to remove my objection to adoption of the CS. Thought I had done that since we're amending it. But we're okay with the amendments to the CS, even though we hadn't fully. So I'd move conceptual amendment number 2, which is to page 2, line 23. And that is deleting January and putting in July. And the reason for that is the department said it needs a little more time to be able to implement all those guidelines, to write the guidelines and conduct the short pilot. Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number 2, page 2, line 23, deleting January and replacing that with July? Seeing none, we've adopted conceptual amendment number two, and conceptual amendment number three, I'd like to offer, which is to page two, lines 5, 8, and 10. And what we're going to do is delete the word standards and replace it with the word regulations. And the purpose of that amendment is to make sure we're not into the department thinking we're saying they have to make a standards-based pilot, that they are adopting regulations and they have the freedom to adopt the pilot with a vendor or with a current provider's system or another design.
Mr. Chairman?
Objection, Representative Attar.
I'm going to object.
Representative Attar.
because this is a pilot program, I'm wondering if that's why it's developed with the standards language rather than regulations, because if they have to draft regulations, then they'll have to go through the whole formal process for drafting regulations. And I'm just thinking for a situation where it's a pilot program, maybe that is different. And that's why it says standards, you know, sort of. So those are the guidelines for that pilot program, mm-hmm. that if it's successful and the department chooses later to implement it, then they would go through the regulatory process and that would be applied for everyone.
And since you're in the seat there, Deb, would regulations get in the way of meaning formal regulations, and should that be, or could that be guidelines instead of standards and still fit within the meaning, or is it standards? What would the department prefer?
Mr. Chair, through the chair, the department, this is Deb Etheridge for the record, Deputy Director of Senior and Disability Services, and the department would, in order to implement on a timely basis and be effective, guidelines or standards would be preferred, and the department would adopt regulations if it was required in order to ensure funding through the Medicaid program. So it would be a task that we would move forward with if we were required to. But to allow us the flexibility to administer a pilot program using standards or guidelines would be helpful.
Okay, thank you. And what we're trying to do is just make sure that whatever system is there, let's say it's a provider system, because I know we have some large PCAs that said we have our system, we use it for monitoring it, we could turn on this location services and verification element of that. We just want to make sure that it's not just useful for them, but it's useful for the state verifying. And so would guidelines work with that, or is standards what you would like to see there? And I'm going to talk to the sponsor of the bill too, because
my colleague's comments, Representative Tarr's comments, that the usage of regulations, that's a real formal process and could be overly burdensome for a pilot project. On the other hand, Mr. Chairman, I think your intent is excellent in that you're striving to avoid any confusion, because you're not saying that the standard base is imposed. So perhaps if with the agreement of the deputy director, perhaps standards here can be replaced by the word guidelines, so there's no confusion?
Through the chair, yes, I would think that would.
Was that mm-hmm. better?
Okay. Correct.
Thank you. For the record. Mm-hmm. So,
Mr. Chair. Would you like to offer that as a friendly amendment to replacing, because we moved conceptual amendment number three, and to replace guidelines or regulations with guidelines?
Yes.
Okay. It has been moved that in conceptual amendment number three, the replacement word for standards will be guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any objection to that? I, as a mover, maker of the
motion, I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
I accept that, and Representative Tarr has removed her objection. Is there any further objection to conceptual amendment number 3 as amended? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number 3 is adopted, which is to page 2, lines 5, 8, and 10, deleting the word standards and replacing that with guidelines. Mm-hmm. Are there further amendments to version N? Thank you. And I think we are. Is there any discussion? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. just wanted to save my comments for the end, and this is a topic of interest and have been working through some constituent cases because the department in the last couple of years has made some pretty significant changes to the PCA program and the amount of time allotted and, you know, really tightened that up. So just, you know, wanted to give some comments from one of the providers in my area that we talked about. Just in terms of, you know, making sure it's a successful pilot, trying to remember the unique circumstances of Alaska that we need to have consideration, that cost effectiveness should be something that is considered, and that's something that's come up, you know, in the sort of cost per transaction. As they told us before, the billing is on that 15-minute increment, you know, if you round up about $6 every 15 minutes. So, you know, on the provider end of things, from a business perspective, they have that about $24, you know, for each hour. If they're paying someone $15, $16 an hour, insurance and other things. So just that being cost-effective is going to, you know, if there's a, you know, process that's going to be implemented that everyone is required to participate in, the cost effectiveness is going to be really critical to making that work. A couple of other things, you know, I wondered about the quality assurance and in having a conversation, you know, we talked a bit about how this, what's happened in the last few years with new regulations, and then in the last 6 years there's been new regulations as well, and that's what cracked down on the time allotment, as well as two changes to the waiver program. So a lot of the fraud in the PCA program may have been eliminated through these prior actions. So just to be careful that we don't have, you know, sort of expect more than we might get out of this in terms of cost savings. And from the provider that I was speaking with, you know, she really felt like, you know, there were some bad actors because sort of, you know, this whole thing grew pretty rapidly, assisted living home, PCA, and then the department has had to come back in and kind of, you know, wind things down. And so so that, you know, much of the fraud may be gone, so just that we need to be realistic about our expectations. And then also on the quality assurance, just to be reminded that PCA services are only provided for individuals who can live independently. So she said in the case of her business, if one of her PCAs doesn't show up, it's the client who actually calls and reports it. You know, hey, the person didn't show up because they were relying on them for, you know, help with bathing or food or laundry or, you know, other, you know, kind of essential day-to-day living needs. So in that sense, hopefully, you know, some of that is addressing, even without this bill, some of the potential fraud because the client themselves would call. And, of course, the business then, you know, has to provide those services. And so just today, since it's just a pilot program, I'm not going to object to the bill moving forward, but just in having that conversation, wanted to put those comments on the record of expectations for what we might see. And just, you know, I'm very supportive of the PCA program because if folks are not able to stay in their home, of course the alternative is so much more costly, and we have limited, you know, long-term residential facility beds. So you know, my goal is always to make these programs work really well so that more people can stay in their home and be closer to their families. And just thinking in that comparison of the Tennessee example or Florida, I think Rep. Vasquez mentioned, just a quick search there, they have about 4 million, you know, people, or 25 times the number of people we do on Medicaid services in their state. So, you know, when we're thinking about cost savings, that we're, you know, much, much, much smaller opportunity there. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have four members of the committee here. Is there anybody that is objecting to moving? Representative Vasquez, would you like to?
Yes. Thank you. I move the CS for HB 315 version 29-LS1287/N, N as in Nancy, from committee as amended with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
And seeing no objection, we will do that. And I will note for the record that there are several fiscal notes, but they were to different versions of the bill, so the forthcoming fiscal note will be on the N version. So with that, seeing no objection, CS for House Bill 315 version N will move from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, and we will be at recess until tomorrow at 3:30 in room 106. Recess.